And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. With me is Phil Conlon. How are you doing?
Yeah, good afternoon, Phil.
And today we're gonna talk about the obvious, I guess. The NATO is making up its mind about Syria, and we're going to be talking to Rick Rozoff in Chicago, who is the founder, producer, and editor, and sometime writer at StopNATO.com, a wonderful site. And Rick Rozoff was also a central figure in the recent demonstrations in Chicago. That was an encouraging sign. Popular questioning resistance to NATO and its aggressive impulses these days. Later in the show, we'll talk to Zafar Bengash, who is an authority on matters to do with Syria, Turkey, Iran. And we'll be asking basically the same questions on everybody. What is going on? How dangerous is this situation? What sort of prospects do we have? And so we'll be taking it up. By the way, today is a celebrated day. This is July. No, it is not July. This is June 25th. And in 1876, a great battle was fought in areas now part of Montana called the Little Bighorn. And a famous American general named Custer miscalculated somewhat. Maybe that's the appropriate note to strike. It never crossed his mind that anything bad could happen because he had more horses, or he thought he had more guns, and he certainly had. He was weighted down with arrogance, and a lot of great films. One called Little Big Man, in my opinion, captured that. And incidentally, the film Little Big Man was aimed at the Vietnam War. They consciously were portraying the events at the Little Bighorn, where, by the way, Custer and the 7th Cavalry were completely wiped out, so badly wiped out that for about, 100 years, they said, we can't find all of our men. We found most of them, but we haven't found all the bodies. And the Native Americans said, well, they're right where we told you they were. And they said, well, here's where the battle was, the famous last stand. And the Natives said, there wasn't any last stand. You don't seem to know what happened, do you? And they pointed out that the American soldiers, being smart, began to run when they realized that what was going to happen. And a good number of them ran down along the creek, it's a very small body of water, where they didn't escape. And sure enough, some American historians and Native historians went over and said, okay, let's do a dig, and sure, there they were. So, but because Hollywood and various artists had pictured this blonde guy standing with his hat blowing in the wind and his hair and his pistols standing on a hill with a bunch of people, had totally misportrayed the events. The Battle of the Little Bighorn, you should understand, was initiated by Custer, I think, in the early morning. He attacked an encampment, and in that encampment were two very famous, I can't name them all, but certainly Crazy Horse was there, and Sitting Bull. And they carried, so he decided he would make a direct blow. He was going to break it up. And the Native Americans saw him coming and anticipated the attack, and so they were prepared for the counterattack. And their estimate is the battle lasted anywhere from 15 to 30 minutes until there were no more members of the 7th Cavalry. The only survivor that day, or there were two or three, but one was a little big man, I think. But he survived because Custer didn't trust him and had regarded him as a coward. He could often find the smart soldiers. They're called cowards. Anyhow, he was told to go somewhere else, and because this was all the glory was going to go to the others. All the others went to glory is what happened. Anyway, I'm glad that we can have an opportunity to talk about this when we're anticipating soon talking to Rick Rozoff of StopNATO.com. If you have an internet, if you have a computer, go to StopNATO.com, and you can, every day, Rick Rozoff assembles highly pertinent articles. By the way, the piece that we're going to ask him about today is titled Syria, NATO and Syria, Not If But When. That was published before the Turkish airplane story. And he has others which are very, very pertinent. Another article titled Sykes-Picot, The Return of Sykes-Picot. And these are matters we have to ask him. And by golly, we got him. Are you there, Rick?
Yeah, hi, Phil. How are you?
Very good. Sorry, we're a little delayed in getting you, but we did get you. Let's start off with NATO. You're the authority, and you have a wonderful website, stopnato.com. And Turkey is asking that NATO have a meeting tomorrow.
That's right.
Indeed, they're going to have it, I guess. And you have published an article titled Not If But When. And how do you see all this unfolding? What do you make of this meeting, and how is it so easy for Turkey to just call a meeting?
Well, technically, of course, any member of NATO reserves the right to call a meeting of what's called the North Atlantic Council. It's the chief governing body of the military bloc, a civilian governing body, and it's composed of the representatives from the respective member states. So, for example, Turkey's ambassador to NATO and those of the other 27 member states will be convening tomorrow to discuss what, if the press reports you're alluding to are accurate, will be a discussion of what is called an Article 5 response by the entire U.S.-dominated military bloc to the incident in the eastern Mediterranean last Friday, that is the downing of a Turkish plane over Syrian territory, territorial waters. I think one thing your listeners may be interested in, there is a precedent for this. There's an Article 5, which is in essence a mutual military assistance clause. Both Articles 4 and 5 are that. Mm-hmm. But 5 is what was invoked after 9/11 2001, to commit NATO to, the so-called global war on terror. Particularly, Article 5 is what is responsible for all NATO countries and most all NATO partners deploying troops to Afghanistan over the last decade plus.
Mm-hmm.
But Article 4 in itself is enough to ensnare other NATO members in a potential conflict, not only with Syria, but in a larger regional conflagration potentially. And what I wanted to remind your listeners of is there is a precedent for this. In February of 2003, the month before the U.S. and Britain invaded Iraq, Article 4 was discussed and invoked in relation to Turkey, but in this case, vis-a-vis Iraq rather than Syria. And what occurred as a result is NATO deployed 5 Patriot interceptor missile batteries to Turkey, 3 of them Dutch, 2 American, 4 AWACS surveillance aircraft, and over 1,000. I'm reading from the NATO website right now, as a matter of fact, what's described as over 1,000 technically advanced and highly capable forces were amongst those deployed to Turkey at the time.
And to protect Turkey from Iraq?
Precisely. I mean, but what are we seeing but an equally ludicrous analogy right now, no?
Yes, you're right.
That military powerhouse Turkey needs to be defended against Syria, which is in turmoil, isolated, sanctioned, and so forth. So it's an inversion, of course, of the truth. This is pretty standard for NATO and the U.S. But what happened was the operation in question 9 years ago, it was called Operation Display Deterrent. And it lasted all late February of 2003 through to May, which is to say, a good month and a half after the invasion of Iraq, and has to be seen as an integral part of the lead-in to that invasion, as well as the invasion and subsequent military operations in the country.
Now, by the way, now this raises two. Turkey's stance is very special. They're a longstanding NATO member, right? I mean, they've been there a long.
That's since 1953.
They came in almost 52, in the ground. 1953. On the ground floor.
Yeah, they and Greece were the two countries in the first enlargement process, if you will.
Well, do they? What about? I think that the world that wants to see not a war and wants to see a resolution of matters and as stabilization, everybody likes to say, would be, seems to me obviously be asking, why does Turkey, a NATO member, engage in highly reckless behavior? I mean, does the rest of NATO know it when one of their military aircraft fly at a low speed, a low altitude, high speed toward a country that is experiencing a crisis?
One would have to assume. Now, that's not true for all NATO members. I'm sure the United States and Great Britain, for example, don't condescend to notify other NATO members about everything they're doing militarily. But in the case of Turkey, you know, given the sensitive nature of the regional situation that you remark, you know, the fact that not only does it border Syria and Iraq, but Iran, they would hardly take a military measure like that without regional NATO headquarters, particularly those in Italy and in Turkey, you know, being aware of what they were doing. And I think the only reasonable conclusion to draw from the incident of late last week is that the, you know, the Turkish Phantom fighter jet was sent there to either probe defenses or provoke, you know, the response it received. And, the, you know, the Syrian account of this is that the plane was shot down by machine gun fire from the ground. I mean, air defenses, but, you know, not missiles, and a part of the air defense system, but not missiles. And the Syrian government is claiming... But the Syrian government is claiming the, you know, the tail of the plane, which has been reclaimed, you know, in fact, shows that to have been the case. So you're not talking about a terribly sophisticated air defense system. You're talking about a plane that almost, that looks like somebody wanted shot down.
Yes, it wanted it to be fired on a kind of... let me see, what's our famous incident off the coast of Vietnam?
Yeah, the Gulf of Tonkin.
Yeah, kind of Tonkin-like matter. You just, and by the way, I mean, we ought to tell share with the listeners, I mean, I'm sure you studied this for years, that we're quite aware that, particularly in the good old days of Soviet-U.S. relations, there was a lot of bumping and pushing carried out by NATO, where they would definitely penetrate or get close to the other guy's space just to see what he would do.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the ways of gauging what the response would be in a genuine conflict, of course. It's also, you know, a sort of brinkmanship where you, you see how far you can push them and how many concessions the other side is willing to make.
It's kind of like the bully exercise in a park, right? He just shoves you and sees what and dares you to resist. Syria's behavior, by the way, I mean, they did stop this plane, and but I know their language is very careful. They said we weren't firing at Turkey. We were firing at a plane. It entered our military plane in our airspace, which is entirely appropriate for any country in the world.
And my assumption would have to be their air defenses are such that such an action is automatic. I mean, it's not even one that needs clearance, say, from the, you know, the top military brass, much less the government. That when a plane intrudes into territorial space, that it's shot at. You know, it's maybe, you know, warned. I don't know the technical matters here, but you know, I think you prefaced the, our discussion correctly, Phil, in that knowing that Turkey has been under siege effectively now for at least, you know, 15 months, to run any risk of sending a foreign air, a military aircraft, you know, into its space or anywhere near it. One can be assured that you know, anyone under siege is hyper vigilant, is alert, and you know, I don't want to use the word trigger happy, but I think that you know, you do shoot when you suspect someone is coming at you first, and you know, so what other response would Turkey have expected?
Certainly, they would. If your job is to defend that space and you're in military and you pick up a craft that's coming toward you at a high speed, there's really nothing to debate about it. You either get do your job or you're going to have a big problem.
That's correct.
You don't actually know what they are bearing, and he's not talking to you, by the way. And there's all this stuff about, well, why didn't you warn us? How could you possibly? There's no time. That's why people get shot down.
Yeah, the only question is, I think, as both of us are skirting the edge of asking, is, you know, whether this was a ill-conceived but nevertheless legitimate accident on the behalf of Turkey, or whether it was, in fact, an effort to provoke something larger. And judging by the response, you know, the characteristically undiplomatic language of America's top nominal diplomat, Mm-hmm. I'm talking about the egregious Hillary Clinton.
Yes.
And, you know, a comparable statement today, a little more toned down by the European Union. It, you know, certainly presents the scenario where people have leapt on this, salivated over it, as somebody has described, perhaps yourself,
yes,
to me, and that it's not so much that this is simply a felix culpa, a happy accident, but that it, in fact, is something, you know, eagerly intended. And then when it's realized, you see the kind of, you know, unrestrained joy that we haven't seen Hillary Clinton manifest, incidentally, since last October when she was shown the gruesome photographs of a murdered Muammar Gaddafi and said, wow, we came, we saw, he's dead. Yes. It was one of those moments of rare elation.
I'm really glad you remark on that, because increasingly we are seeing highly visible American political leaders who want to be photographed or recorded saying really macabre things. They don't. They don't represent an office. I mean, they so much as just a kind of a got 'em or a beat 'em up attitude. We have the president saying that he personally signs off on the murder list of targets, and then you have the Secretary of State. I mean, it's a worrying phenomenon. I want to ask you about France. We may as well point out. I mean, you know, you and others were organized against the G20 and NATO coming to Chicago. We look for political leaders, some who would raise basic questions. We know the name Ron Paul, and Mr. Kucinich is no longer in Congress. And then they said, well, you know, Sarkozy seems to be a crazy right-winger, but now we have a socialist government. Well, the socialist government of France is biting at the bit, right? They're ready to go.
Yeah, Ed, we may have discussed this in a previous program, but, you know, I certainly didn't anticipate any substantive foreign policy shift with the Hollande government in France versus Sarkozy. You know, Sarkozy was hyper-ambitious. I mean, the comparison has been drawn by more people than me in a Napoleonic manner. And his project for, you know, Mediterranean Union, which I think in large part factored into the war against Libya last year, that is Libya alone being non-compliant and going along with the project. So, I mean, there are differences in that respect. Some are more grandiose, some are more provocative than others. But, you know, you have ruling elites who have polities that are not going to change because one administration comes and another leaves.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about the role of the UN here in Russia. People should appreciate this is not undangerous. I mean, there does seem to be an attitude that we're never going to get into any, nobody here is going to get hurt. We're just going to go and rush somebody up. And we have the United Nations was brought into this. But as I look at the personnel, this General Mood is a Norwegian, if I'm not wrong.
That's right.
And Mr. Ban Ki-moon is a South Korean right-wing. And basically, everybody considers him a U.S. puppet.
He is.
Kofi Annan was chosen by Madeleine Albright to replace
Boutros-Ghali. I mean, she deposed Boutros-Ghali and then brought in Annan as you know, as her personal lapdog.
Yeah. Apropos, I remember that she said, somebody said, "Well, Boutros-Ghali and you must not get along." And she said, "I'll shake his hand, but I'll break his back."
Oh, I never heard that quote. And indeed she did.
Yeah, she did break his back. So when we look at this, I mean, you know, the UN would almost be as much of a problem as a solution here because, of course, it was General Mood that decided to create a crisis last week by saying, well, we're suspending our work. And immediately Hillary and others jumped in. I want to know, what do you think the UN role is going to be here? I mean, are they going to go back to Security Council? And if they do, what will happen?
That's a really good question. I think everything rides on, you know, weather, in fact. You know, the scheduled June 30th meeting in Geneva called really on the initiative of Russia to have, you know, a broader discussion of the Syrian situation by regional powers. Russia is still insisting.
Yeah, but that has been basically an immediate here, almost shrugged off and forgotten. I'm glad you're reminding us. Are the Russians still publicly going forward with that idea, or are we just in a blackout about it?
Last heard, Phil, and they, you know, are consistent in insisting that Iran, being a major regional nation, also attend. And of course, the West is pushing against that and arguing that Iran should be, because they're presumably next.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the West arbitrarily deciding, you know, who is or is not a regional party that should be part of discussions about what's happening in Syria. Though I suspected for a long time, I would imagine you have too, that the U.S. and its Western allies, its NATO allies, would love to sabotage that Geneva meeting. Mm-hmm. And last Friday's incident with the Turkish warplane is certainly one way of doing that. Mm-hmm. Conferences have been torpedoed for reasons less severe than that. And the West has no interest in anything like a negotiated settlement, even. And we can I think, argue effectively that the Annan Arab League UN plan was really, entailed a major concession by the government of Syria.
Yeah.
I can't imagine for a moment a U.S. ally like Bahrain, allowing a United Nations inspection mission inside the country, nor would it be pressured to do so.
Now, Israel has told various UN bodies to leave.
Yeah, there you go.
This is Rick Rozoff, StopNATO.com. By the way, from now on, you're going to need to be going to that site every day, because we need to see the kind of articles and material that is available. They're not available, particularly from places like India, China, Russia, and Iran, and other places where major players are talking but not being heard in the West. So it's very important, this site. Hearing speculation or reading it, that they really expect to maybe move to a blockade and a no-fly zone kind of approach. Are you seeing those stories?
Sure. It's a typical a toolkit that has been employed for the last 20 years. We've seen it repeatedly. It begins with the sanctions, which have already been enforced and by the EU, by the United States, and allied countries against Syria. Then it becomes travel bans and government officials, family members, freezing the financial assets of government officials, maybe the government as a whole eventually, mooting the point of international criminal court case charges being brought against military and civilian officials in the country. But we've heard increasingly talk about a so-called free zone or buffer zone. As a matter of fact, a year ago, or at least a year ago, Turkey was talking about creating a buffer zone some number of miles, 20 or 30 miles inside the Syrian border. Then it becomes a no-fly zone, and once the no-fly zone is implemented, then it's all-out war. I mean, that follows as surely as night does day, and we've seen it in Yugoslavia and in Iraq and Libya last year.
Mm-hmm. This is Rick Rozoff, and the site is stopnato.com. The one issue seems to be way up front, and all wars have this quality. And I wonder if you could comment on some. I saw I think it was a Russian commentator, but he was saying we have NATO now has a kind of atrocity management faculty. That is, they put stories, a horror story, in front of people, and then give themselves the task of correcting the wrong.
And I think, as you've explained to me, Phil, maybe in a private conversation once, NATO loves to set itself up as the coy maiden who needs to be courted.
Oh, yes.
And that
beg me, ask me,
right.
Urge me.
We
have liberal editorials here. That's what they say is, NATO is just dithering.
Yeah, or rather, to be more accurate, the seemingly coy harlot, who is more than willing to enter the fray, but has to appear to be asked or begged, or paid court to, before they'll do it, or she'll do it, or NATO will do it. But that's it. Their heads of state and their foreign ministers and so forth, clamor, and their gutter journalism that passes for establishment.
Well, they have a horrible incident, and then they talk as though they all know what happened.
Yes.
I don't live there, and I know that none of these people who are doing all this talking, they don't live there, they don't speak Arabic, but they're all authorities on what happened in a country far, far away.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if your listeners know or remember Edgar Allan Poe's story, Murders in the Rue Morgue, but there's a scene in the boarding house after the killing has been done, and they're interviewing several people, all of whom know who did it. who committed the murder. And as I recall, a Danish fellow says that it was an Italian. And he's asked, have you ever been in Italy? No. Do you know any Italian? No. And so and this goes around with the whole group. Yeah, but this is, omniscience that comes simply from passing on bogus photographs.
On what they know about Irishmen. He must have done that.
But we should make light of this. But
You for choosing that example. People will not want to read political, but they'll rush to read Murder in the Rue Morgue. So I think you put us onto something.
but it takes an Inspector Dupin to suss it out and deal with real evidence rather than people's harebrained ideas about what occurred. And what we're talking about here is, I think that the governments and their allied or subservient media outlets are still playing off an old script, and it's one where they could tell a lie about whatever happened any place in the world, and nobody would be able to gainsay it. But in the computer age, that's not the case.
Mm-hmm.
And we now have instant access to information in real time and on the ground.
Yeah.
It was remarked in the 1999 78-day air war against Yugoslavia by the U.S. and NATO that it was the first internet war, and it was. And it differed in that respect, of course, from, let's say, Operation Desert Storm of 8 years earlier, where we didn't find out until months, sometimes years later, the full carnage that was wreaked on the so-called Highway of Death, or how many civilians have been blown to pieces in the Al Amaria Hotel in Baghdad. It was information that only emerged after it was too late to voice any genuine opposition to it, but that time is gone.
Yeah.
And when unsubstantiated claims are made about the nature of killings in Hula or in other parts of Syria, it doesn't take terribly long to hear a different version of events.
Yes. What we need is a skeptical public so that they go and do that homework. Because it is, you're right, it's available, particularly, by the way, available at stopnato.com. But, that is people, most folks are suspicious of the local politicians and whatnot, and when he says something, they think, I wonder. Well, that's the way they should treat the Syria story.
People seem to be more credulous in inverse proportion to the proximity of it. So, if you're correct, they know that somebody telling them what's happening in the next block is lying, but they're ready to believe the same person or his or her equivalent if they're talking about what's happening on the other side of the world.
The oldest city, inhabited city in the world, Damascus. This is Rick Rozoff, and you had an article which I think we brought out would make a good closer on this point. The article discussed the old British-French agreement, Sykes-Picot, isn't it? Saying that not only is it neocolonialism, it's old colonialism, and that agreement, they say, is going to be the model for what the NATO intends to do. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, I remember once talking to somebody from the Middle East who showed me the line that separates Syria from Lebanon, and there was one little small obtrusion, as you will. It wasn't, the line didn't flow evenly. And he said, the standing joke is that that's where somebody's middle finger was as they were tracing, the map. It was that arbitrary when France and Britain, right during the height of World War I, of course, decided to divide up, the former Ottoman territories in the Levant. Mm-hmm. And that what we're looking at, this isn't too obscure. I'm sure many of your listeners may know. A retired U.S. military official named Ralph Peters years ago, issued a map of the New Middle East, which is on, online, this Ralph Peters map, New Middle East, which was used at NATO colleges and other training institutions. It's not official, the Defense Department, but nevertheless, it made the rounds. And it's a map that shows, at least one scenario for what a post-revolutionary New Middle East will look like, and includes, an aggregated Kurdistan, a unified Baluchistan, carved out of Pakistan and Iran, and, redivision of, several other countries. And I think what we're looking at is some modern Sykes-Picot sort of arbitrary decision made by, somebody sitting in Western capitals to reconfigure the Middle East in a manner that is advantageous to Western powers, acceptable to Israel, maybe granting Turkey some neo-Ottoman prerogatives that it's missed over the last century. Heaven knows how these people think.
When I looked at that map, I noticed that they took a port away from Syria. If you look at it, it's a notch, and it's a wonderful deep-water port. And I thought, well, I guess Syria has come off short, and they gave it to Turkey.
Well, I wasn't aware of that.
And so it must have been, the Turks must have felt, oh, well, at least we're semi-European. They gave us the best port after Beirut. And, of course, Beirut, they put in Lebanon. I think we probably don't go wrong in assuming that these are not terribly noble or well-intentioned people that are doing all this heavy work on the region.
Yeah, you know, we have to remember it wasn't too long ago. It was both prior to and after the invasion of Iraq in 2003. That, as I recollect, you know, people like Joseph Biden, our vice president of the United States, was talking about, you know, what on the surface looked like a, you know, federal system that would essentially divide the country into three, you know, northern Kurdish area, southern Shia area, and, you know, central Sunni area in Iraq. But that, you know, I think a more seasoned observer of these events understood would be a balkanization of Iraq into three, you know, quasi-states. Mm-hmm. And that something quite like this may be planned for Syria with concessions, you know, reapportioning or repartitioning or partitioning the country and, you know, maybe throwing parts of it as a sop to a couple of adjoining nations as a way of rewarding them for being loyal to the West. I mean, I have no idea what madmen think, unfortunately. But,
now you're boasting. I don't.
Yeah, I mean, maybe I lack imagination.
You don't have evil intent. By the way, Rick, I must realize I have to ask you one more question if you've got a few moments. I forgot to point out that in your website does that, and this is stopnato.com, is that these Qatari-financed and Saudi-financed fighters have a group now in Kosovo for unspecified reasons. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I wish I knew more, but I can tell you what I know. And this is perhaps 8 weeks ago, one of the leaders of, you know, what's called the Syrian National Council, that is the opposition abroad.
Yeah, the one in London.
Yeah, right. And, you know, whose leader up until perhaps a week and a half ago is a professor at the Sorbonne. But in the case of the person I'm thinking of, he lived in Washington, D.C. for the past 7 years, since 2005. Was a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution, you know, like all Syrians, right?
Mm-hmm.
Typical
yes.
Syrian.
Yes.
And, you know, hadn't been in his homeland and, and probably doesn't intend to ever return there.
It's trustworthy.
You know, yeah, except as the Coriolanus, you know, as the ruler implanted from abroad. But nevertheless, mm-hmm. he had met with officials probably not far from his house in Washington, D.C., U.S. federal officials. And then from there was taken to the capital of Kosovo, Pristina, where, according to the Associated Press, to whom he had granted an interview, he met with former leaders of the Kosovo Liberation Army, which would include, I have to assume, you know, the current head of state, Prime Minister Hashim Thaçi, and most of his cronies, who, you know, were leaders in the KLA, to learn. And I'm roughly paraphrasing the, you know, the Syrian in exile, but it's fairly close to what he said, Phil. He said, we are particularly impressed with your ability to pull together various strands or disparate fighting groups into one unified fighting force, which in fact was done for the KLA by the United States and other Western special forces and intelligence agencies in Albania and Macedonia in 1998 and 1999. But, you know, all but suggesting, you know, let's replicate this model, wonderful model to choose, looking at the results in Kosovo for the last 13 years, and that's ironic. But there are other reports that there are parts of the terrain of Kosovo that resemble parts of those, the terrain in Syria, and that these would be ideal conditions under which to train for fighting.
Well, quite a story. And no doubt these people are rather tight, and they're big, well-financed friends. Rick Rosoff, boy, it's a pleasure talking to you. You're full of information. The site, stopnato.com, is a great contribution. Thank you very, very much. Always good to talk to you.
Yeah, and thank you for having me on, Phil.
Okay, Doug. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That's Rick Rosoff, stopnato.com. And we're going to take a quick break. I'm going to tell you something about Rwanda when we get back, and then we're going to talk to Zafar Bengash. And we're back. Taylor Report. And we're here with Phil Conlon. Phil Conlon also has a great program every Tuesday, 12 o'clock, Classical Underground. Did I get it?
You got it right, Classical Underground. We're on tomorrow at noon.
What are you doing tomorrow?
We are investigating the teaming of musicians together in duets. And music is a world where people learn to cooperate, which is one of the reasons why I like promoting it.
Great. It's the greatest way to show how you can bring people together. Somebody hums, next somebody else hums. Pretty soon you got everybody doing it. That was how Coca-Cola sold the product. Right? They had everybody.
They actually stole somebody's song, and it was a very nice song.
But it's brilliant.
And they
you
got
to agree, because course, they were playing on everybody's heart.
Of course.
We would like to do that.
Yeah.
This is the Taylor Report at CIUT. It's 89.5 FM, and you can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm, and check us out on the our website, taylor-report.com, for all these broadcasts that we've done over time. And there's a very important story about Rwanda, and we often speak of it here. You know that the woman who returned to from Holland and to become a political opposition, and her desire was to run for president. She is in prison. She is she's had everybody agrees, a show trial, which turned out to be a lousy show, really ugly, because the Canadian government, the American government, just hugged Paul Kagame to death. He's their favorite guy. He's the one who endorsed their invasion of Iraq, the only country in Africa to do so. So that was called a reward for a colleague. But here's the news from South Africa, very important. Rwandan general accuses Kagame. Johannesburg, June 21st. A Rwandan general, who was once a top aide to Rwandan President Paul Kagame, but now is among his most prominent critics, said Thursday that Kagame ordered the killing of the previous president that sparked the Rwanda 1994 genocide. General Faustin Kayumba Nyamwasa made the accusation Thursday as he testified in a Johannesburg courtroom about an attempt on his own life in 2010 in South Africa. The shooting, and he was shot, the shooting of Nyamwasa and developments in other countries have raised suspicions that Rwandan government has deployed hit teams against dissidents abroad. Rwanda denies the accusations. Asked why the three Rwandans and three Tanzanians on trial may have wanted him dead, Nyamwasa, once Kagame's military chief, described a breakdown in his relationship with Kagame. I ran out of the country because my life was threatened, Nyamwasa testified. Nyamwasa fled in 2010 to South Africa, where he was shot months after arrival. Nyamwasa testified Thursday the bullet remains lodged at the base of his spinal column. These guys really play for keeps. Rwanda's government has denied involvement in an attempted murder. Nyamwasa testified Thursday that another Rwandan exiled in South Africa allowed him to listen in secret to a telephone call with a top Rwandan army official in Rwanda. Nyamwasa said the caller from Rwanda was looking for someone to help eliminate Nyamwasa. Nyamwasa said he reported the conversation to South African authorities before he was shot, but that his security was stepped up only after the shooting. He added, as further explanation of why he may have been targeted, there are facts in my knowledge that the president of Rwanda ordered the killing of the former president of Rwanda, President Habyarimana. Rwanda's 100-day genocide was sparked by the shooting down of the president, Juvenal Habyarimana's plane in 1994. So it's very important to know about this. It is not being reported in the Toronto Star, Globe and Mail, elsewhere, where they're happy to ship an accused Rwandan back to Rwanda to face trial. When here you have a high-ranking general, and there's no question, Nyamwasa was a big-time leader, along with Paul Kagame, who's almost been murdered himself for speaking out. And I would say, and this is no surprise, if you go back to 1996, 97, there was a member of the Rwandan government named Seth Sendashonga. Everybody agrees that Seth Sendashonga was murdered on the streets of Nairobi by agents of the Kagame government of Rwanda. And he had visited the United Nations International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda and said, you know, look, I'm the former interior minister of Rwanda. I have had to flee for my own life because I differed with the leader about what should be going on in the country. And he said, also, I had asked a couple of questions. What happened to Habyarimana? Because that ought to be investigated. He had asked that. And two, there had been a massacre, a total massacre of Hutu refugees inside the country at a place called Gbeho. And we have on this program interviewed New Zealand and Australian, I think, soldiers who were witnesses. And it's a horrible story to listen to. These were all there, supposedly peacekeeping or whatever. And those people were murdered. Sesa Ndashanga, very courageous, was living in Nairobi. I was there, went to Nairobi to see him on one occasion. He was shot down. We have people in town here, and the Toronto Star has people who regularly apologize and say, well, you know, we don't know who did that. Well, you got to remember, Sesa Ndashanga was not shot once. There was an attempted assassination once, he was in a car, and the driver was killed. It happened to be his nephew. The nephew was killed, and he himself was wounded. But he survived, and was recovered. He had seen the assassin, and the assassin, attempted assassin, and that was a member of the Rwandan embassy. But they used diplomatic immunity to get him out of the country. So with his own eyes, Sesa Ndashanga, the wounded victim, said that was a Rwandan guy. He was identified. He was found with the gun, by the way. But he was allowed to leave the country. Now, and then later, 6 months later, he was shot dead. And United States, Canada, Britain, they all said, oh, I'm looking at a cloud. Me, I'm studying the ground. I'm looking out at sea. I didn't notice, and I don't hear anything. Now you have a general who's almost been murdered in South Africa by the same gang in Kigali. And, you know, the major media here let it go by. Well, anyway, Taylor Report doesn't let it go by. CIUT doesn't let it go by. And other things we don't let go by is a chance to talk to Zafar Bengash. Are you there, Zafar?
Hello, Phil. Yes, I am.
Thank you very much for joining us. I think we're right on schedule. Good. You're the man who has traveled in. You've been to Syria. You've been to Turkey. You've traveled all through the region. You certainly know the dynamics. Let's start with this issue. What is your take on what has happened between Turkey and Syria, this airplane incident?
Well, it is obvious that the Turkish plane was sent deliberately because the Turks have confirmed that it was flying very low, only about 4,000 feet above the ground. And on Friday, when the plane was shot down by the Syrians, Turkish President Abdullah Gül was reported by the BBC confirming that the plane had strayed into Syrian airspace. But he said that it was inadvertent.
Yeah.
Now, if that is the case, why was the plane flying so low?
Mm-hmm.
What I read into this is that it was a deliberate attempt to try to figure out the capability of Syria's radar installations, as well as whether they are going to respond. Because we need to keep in mind that this is not the first time that Turkish Air Force jets have violated Syrian airspace. But this time it seemed as if the Syrians were determined, because the government has said that its forces have been issued orders that they should shoot down any intruding aircraft into Syrian airspace.
Which would be the appropriate thing if you were a Canadian Air Force.
Absolutely. If you have a country that has, over the past year and a half, shown great hostility towards you and your government, and there are Syrian rebel groups that are hosted in Turkey, Turkey is providing them facilities, and there is money and weapons coming from Saudi Arabia and Qatar. And the Americans are also supplying them weapons, although they couch it in saying that, well, we have only provided them night vision equipment and communications equipment, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is that a number of countries are deeply involved in financing and arming and training the rebels. And in fact, Turkish intelligence agents and commandos were also captured a couple of months ago in Syria. And then through the intervention of Iran, these Turkish military officers were released. Last week, Syria announced that it has captured a number of Saudi and Qatari mercenaries that have been operating in Syria, and it is going to execute them publicly, hang them publicly, so that it would send a clear lesson and message to other mercenaries that if they dare to come into Syria to provoke this violence, then there are going to be very serious consequences.
It is becoming really dangerous. I want to ask, Zafar, you raised a point which I want to know your thoughts on. They're now starting the game of reporting defections. They have military defections. But I heard about the plane to Jordan, and then I read about a general. But then in the back of my mind, I recall reading a little paragraph in the Toronto Star where they were bragging. The Saudis said that they are prepared to pay salaries of people who will come over.
They are. In fact, the Saudis
And I assume they would say, I'll pay you twice as much as what you're making now, right?
Exactly, exactly. The Saudis have opened their checkbooks and they've said that anybody who, any...
They should be careful. They might pick up a few Canadians. How much?
Exactly. They are flushed with money. I mean, the Saudis earn $1 billion a day in oil income, so they have no shortage of money. And they're willing to spend a few billion dollars on saying that, you know, they have defectors that are fleeing Syria. Because initially, and that is last year, Syria, Qatar, Turkey, and others were hoping that there would be large-scale defections from the Syrian military, but that did not materialize. And so now they are resorting to this these other gimmicks, bribing them, paying them off, etc. But with respect to that plane incident, I want to mention a few other things, and that is that this did not occur in isolation. I think we need to keep in mind that this plane was shot down just about a mile off the coast of Latakia, which is an important Syrian city on the Mediterranean, and it is not very far. It's only about 70 or 80 miles from the Russian naval base of Tartus. Now, I'm sure your viewers would know, or your listeners would know, that Tartus is very important for Syria because that's the only naval base that Syria has in the Mediterranean. And last week, which is June the 18th, a Russian freighter was bringing to Syria reconditioned helicopters, 15 of them, that had been purchased back in the 90s by Syria and paid for them, but they were sent back to Russia to be reconditioned. And the British insurance agencies withdrew insurance coverage from that freighter as it approached the Scottish coast of United Kingdom. And so that freighter, which had set off from Kaliningrad in Russia, had to turn back. And, of course, Russia was furious at it because both the British and the Americans bragged that, or accused, first of all, they accused Russia of supplying arms to Syria, whereas the fact is that these were reconditioned helicopters that had already been paid for back in the 80s and 90s. And secondly, that the Americans and the British said that, well, we have successfully intercepted weapons going to this regime. So what the Russians have done is they took the freighter back, and now that ship that is coming is carrying Russian flag, and it is accompanied by Russian gunboats.
Really?
Absolutely. And now we are seeing this escalation because the Russians are absolutely furious. They have told the Americans, and Hillary Clinton said that Russia is violating this arms embargo against Syria, and it's provoking. And they said, you are the people that are supplying weapons to the rebels. We have international obligations to provide these weapons to Syria. These are legally binding contracts.
Like the ones they have in Bahrain and Qatar and Saudi Arabia.
Exactly. Can you imagine? Like, you know, there the Americans keep on pumping billions of dollars worth of weapons to them. But we see this escalation that is taking place. And the way I read this plain incident situation is that Turkey itself has got itself into a very difficult situation because the Turks, probably the government, thought that the Bashar al-Assad government would collapse quickly. They were expecting it to fall last year, and that has not happened. And so now Turkey is, on the one hand, being pushed by NATO to go into Syria militarily by sending its own forces.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, Turkey is sort of turning around, and it wants NATO to do something. So it is quite possible that as a consequence of this shooting down of the Turkish military jet, that NATO, who are going to meet tomorrow in Brussels, that some kind of a no-fly restriction might be imposed on Syria, which obviously would be an escalation of the conflict. Secondly, I'm sure that you would have noticed that the Kofi Annan mission that had been launched back in May, in fact, the day it was launched, on the very second day or third day, the rebel forces were saying it's not achieving its objective, it should be disbanded, etc., because they do not want a peaceful resolution. So we have this curious situation that on the one hand, the Kofi Annan mission was launched in order to try to work out a negotiated settlement between the rebels and the Syrian government.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, the U.S. and its allies are doing everything to provoke a conflict by supplying weapons to those rebels. So we have this curious dilemma that we face, that the West and the Western governments are claiming that they want to bring about a peaceful resolution, and yet they are precisely the players that are stoking that conflict in the region.
You know, they do. I mean, the best phrase I've heard so far is the one from the UN ambassador for Syria saying, you cannot be an arsonist and a fireman. You have to choose. And you know, if the UN was doing its duty, they would say, now look, here we got the Annan plan. That means that we all have to comply.
Exactly.
We don't get to cheat on this. We set up Annan. He's got a plan.
Yes.
And then we all have to help that work.
Yes.
You can't say, oh, nice plan, I'm going to just arm this guy anyway.
Yes.
By the way, tell us about Turkey and its behavior towards Iraq. I mean, this thing about crossing borders and attacking people, which is now going to become the great hue and cry about, how could Syria resist these guys? Well, Turkey's been behaving like this before in Iraq.
Yes, unfortunately, it's really incredible as to why Turkey has turned to such a belligerent power. When we see that the current Turkish foreign minister was appointed, Ahmet Davutoğlu, who's actually a professor, he has served as professor of international relations, and he has written a very readable book about zero problem policy. He launched that zero problem policy with all of its neighbors, and he had eliminated or proposed and all the neighboring countries, including Iraq, Syria, Iran, even Armenia, with which Turkey has a very long-standing dispute and argument. Even with Armenia, it lifted visa restrictions, so the citizens of the two countries could visit and get their visas at the airport without having to worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
And despite that zero-problem policy that went into effect more than 2 years ago, but once this the problems started, particularly the uprisings in the Middle East, then Turkey's position has taken a 180-degree turn. And so now, regrettably, Turkey has problems with all of its neighbors, including Turkey, including Iraq, including Syria, including Iran.
I have to ask you that one. I mean, could NATO be trying to push its smaller member into a problem with Iran? Because, we should always remind our listeners, too, that Iran, we want to remember, is the target. If there's one target in the region, it's Iran.
Absolutely. In fact, everything that is going on in Syria is part of that obsession that the U.S. and its NATO allies have with Iran, and they want to destabilize it and to overthrow the legitimately established government in Iran that enjoys widespread support of its people. But you're not going to hear about this in any Western media outlets or see it in any Western newspapers. They keep on referring to Iran as that Iranian regime in order to delegitimize it. Yeah. Whereas, in fact, that is the only country in the region over the last 33 years that it has held elections consistently to parliament, to the president, and all other bodies.
And with a really rapid turnover of many personalities, different types of and parties, different interests.
Absolutely. In fact, the president cannot be cannot remain in office for more than two terms. So that sort of automatically allows for fairly quick turnover of personnel. And I must say there is a lot of talent in Iran. I mean, you know, before, for instance, Ahmadinejad became the president, nobody had even heard of him. I mean, the only thing that people knew about him was that he was the mayor of Tehran. And prior to that, he had been the governor of some province. But that's about it. Nobody knew of his administrative capabilities or any other capabilities. And on his watch, I mean, he's done exceptionally well in terms of the services he has provided to the Iranian people. So we can see that there is a lot of talent in Iran, and despite, you know, an eight-year war, for instance, Iran never canceled or suspended its constitution or suspended elections. Yes. Compare that to Britain. When Britain was under attack during the Second World War, the constitution was suspended. There were no elections. There was a government of national unity.
Coalition government.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah. So we can compare that with the oldest democracy and the newest democracy.
Well, if it's a democracy, NATO will come and see if they can change that.
Absolutely.
Zafar Benghazi, it's always a pleasure talking. It's very informative, and we will have to watch this closely. We hope we can talk to you again soon.
Sure, it'll be my pleasure.
Okay.
Thank you, Zafar Benghazi. Thank you.
And I would say, just Google Zafar Benghazi, and you'll be well informed. Phil, you were going to say?
Well, yeah, there's one more country, actually, a very tiny one, actually, that Turkey is angry with these days, too, and that's Cyprus. And that's because the Cypriots are looking for oil, right? So the Turks said, well, no, that plane was really checking up on the Cypriots, right?
Right. No, no, they have, yes, maybe if they do a good deed for Washington, they might get what they want. This is... Phil Taylor for Phil Conlon and Barb. We thank everybody, and we'll see you next week.